Westwood One presents Two Chairs and a Microphone.
Checking 1, 2.
Here's your host, Paul Mercurio.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. Before we get to our guests real quick, I'm touring. I'm going to be in Philadelphia at the Punchline March 2nd to the 4th. I'm going to be at the San Francisco Punchline March 29th to April 1st. I'm going to be in at the Comedy Castle in Royal Oak, Michigan, April 13th to the 15th. That's Easter, so bring chocolate. Anyway, I'm all over the country. Go to my website, paulmercurio.com. You can see where I am. Also, please review the podcast. Those reviews are coming in, and they're great. Go to iTunes, give a quick review. It's a big, big help. We appreciate it very much. And tell your friends about the podcast. And keep listening. We've got a lot of great guests coming up. And none greater than my next guest. How about that for a segue? This is Rabbi Borovitz. And Rabbi Borovitz is not what it sounds like it would be. He is a rabbi. His first name is Mark. And welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Mark is a rabbi that works with people with addiction issues, tell people you're a rabbi at
Beit Tshuva.
Here in Los Angeles is the House of Return. It's a rehabilitation facility for addicts of all kinds. You have a fascinating background. I'm going to be careful what I say. You were a mobster before you took to the Torah, a gangster, a con man, a gambler, a thief, and a drunk. So right now you seem like the last person on earth that would seem that way to me. how long ago was that part of your life?
Well, I've been, I have over 28 years in recovery.
Right. And you have a book out, by the way, right now, which is a great book called Finding Recovery in Yourself in Torah, A Daily Spiritual Path to Wholeness.
Yes.
And I want to get to that in a minute about your sort of, you have a theory about addiction recovery that is a little different than what I've seen from others. But let's sort of give people a little background, because as I mentioned, you have quite an interesting past. Sort of where were you born, and how did that sort of come about, that life? And then sort of how did you move into this part of your life?
That's a great question.
In other words, what the hell was wrong with you, and how did you straighten yourself out?
So,
I'm just kidding.
Well, I got myself in trouble, and I got a lot of help getting straightened out. Let's start off from there. I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. Nice kid, you know.
Shaker Heights?
No, Cleveland Heights.
Oh, okay.
Cleveland
Heights. I went to law school, and one of my buddies that I roomed with was from Shaker Heights. Also a nice Jewish boy.
Yes. And I always felt half a step off. See, Paul, growing up, I didn't know that inside, everybody feels not sure,
insecure.
Questioning, not just insecure, but I thought that I'm looking at you, and I think that you know everything that there is to know about life. You never have any questions. You're just totally certain about it. That was the way I saw everybody. And I knew that I was half a step off, that I wasn't
sure. What does that mean, half a step off? And by the way, just to address what you said, I was a lawyer and investment banker on Wall Street, and I thought I had everything figured out. And then I stumbled into comedy and went through a period where I was completely lost about what to do with my life, and then I ended up leaving to do this. So I don't think anybody has it figured out.
Well, I know that nobody has it figured out.
But when you say you're a half a step off, what did that mean? What did that mean to you then?
That means, then it meant to me, and even now, that everybody else had it figured out, is what I believe. Everybody else,
their life from the outside seemed
right.
Complete
I judged
and perfect.
My insides by other people's outsides.
Yeah, well, that's a lot of people do that.
And so I was always lacking, lacking, lacking.
In what sense? Like sort of academically?
No, not just never
socially.
Spiritually is the only way I can put it. And
so,
and
what
let
does
me
that
explain
mean?
It.
Yeah,
that I was unsure. I grew up unsure of life. I understood the fragility of life. My father, he should rest in peace, had 7 heart attacks in 7 years, the 7th one being fatal from the time I was 7 till 14.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't really count on anything,
mm-hmm.
or at least I was afraid to. And
so you had a lot of worry that sort of around the corner, something bad would happen, and
the other shoe's always going to drop.
So you had sort of a pet. When you say you didn't have the right faith or looked at no, it's sort of a spiritual thing.
It wasn't faith. It was not faith in the way that, that people normally use the term, but it was this deep fear. I was paralyzed by fear and anxiety, inner anxiety. Nothing, you wouldn't see it on the outside or it wasn't a mental deficiency.
And what were you anxious about? Was it anything in particular or just a general anxiety?
A general anxiety that I didn't fit in. I didn't belong in the world that I was living in.
Hmm. And you grew up at a time when people didn't see shrinks. It was medication wasn't really a big thing.
No. And I mean, listen, people saw therapists as I was growing up, but...
But not it like
wasn't,
now.
Right. But it wasn't that kind of a thing. It wasn't that I could point to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened was I kept looking for ways to get out of feeling bad.
Oh.
And after my father died, I really found alcohol and crime.
Hmm. How old were you at the time?
About 14, 15.
Did your father, what kind of relationship did you have with him?
He was my best friend.
Oh, yeah. See, my dad, he died of a heart attack. He was 64 at the time. And I loved him and we were close, but we didn't do a lot of things together.
Now, my father.
And he wasn't a talkative. He was sort of a quiet Italian guy who didn't talk a lot.
Yeah, no, my father was totally involved with his kids. So
that's a big blow. The reason I ask is that's a big blow to lose him. Yeah.
He was my best friend. He's the guy who knew my soul.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah.
And when he spoke to me, it was a different feeling. I knew I was safe.
You felt
I knew
safe.
I was home. I knew I belonged with him.
And what about your mom? She didn't provide that?
My mom is a great lady. She didn't have that. We didn't have that same connection. And after my father died, she had to go to work.
Oh.
And we're talking 1966. My father was 42 when he died.
How many kids?
There was four kids. Three of us were at home.
Wow.
Now, she went to work in 66. She was making $2 an hour.
Jesus.
And the mortgage was $150 a month. So I went to the barber, who was also the local fence for the mafia, and I said, I need to do something to make money. So he gave me hot merchandise and consignment, and I used to sell it. Whatever I sold it for, I gave him half and kept half.
And it started.
Right. I mean, I'm 15, 16 years old. I'm making $200-$300 a week.
Now, were you doing that because you felt a duty to help your mom, or was it because to fill this sort of void and get away from your anxiety?
Both.
What did it do for you from a personal perspective in terms of the anxiety? Did it made you feel successful? Like you were worthy?
I put my net worth and my self-worth together.
A lot of people do that.
If I had money, I was somebody. If I was broke, I was nobody.
It's funny. My uncle had a barbershop. It's weird. We have a similar life. And he ran numbers out of the back to make extra money. And then his son, my cousin, did that and took it a step further and would sell hot goods out of the trunk. He'd pull into the gas. I grew up in Providence, Rhode Island, and he'd pull into the gas station, and one of my friends would pump gas for extra money after school. And he goes, "Yeah, your cousin was here." And I go, "Yeah." He goes, "Yeah, what did he have?" He goes, "Well, he opened the trunk. He had this week he had suits, ratchets. He had car alarms. He literally had stolen car alarms that he took from car." And he didn't even know that. He didn't even get the irony of it. But but it was the same thing. It was like, it was sort of that made man kind of thing.
It gave me a feeling of omnipotence. In high school, I didn't keep books in my lockers. I kept merchandise. I would walk into school broke, and by 11 o'clock, I got $100.
Did you have friends? And did they start to treat you differently when you turned to crime?
They didn't really see it as crime. Most of them.
They just saw it as a kid having some fun. And,
right. Yeah. Now, at the same time, I was also president of the youth group at my temple.
Jesus. Sorry.
I lived a split life, which most people live.
But how does it not, they said Bill Clinton was good at compartmentalizing. How were you able to walk through the synagogue door and not have that on your shoulder?
Because I was a different guy.
But you were you were living a life that was going against everything that you were doing when you walked through that door.
Right, but I compartmentalized because when I was in synagogue, I prayed well. I was very, I'm a committed Jew and everything.
Did you think that was sort of a way for you to give yourself a pass at doing, you know, if I do some of this religious stuff, it doesn't, it's my way of showing forgiveness for the other thing.
Well, I don't know about forgiveness, but I thought it balanced out.
Yeah.
Okay. One balanced the other.
Yeah.
And, also I had to keep up a show.
Yeah. For your friends.
For my friends, for my family. I had to keep up the show.
You're a big shot. You got to keep being
right,
a big shot.
Because I also had a job. I was selling shoes on commission, in a store as a legitimate job. So that's where I told my family the money came from. I was a good salesman, and nobody questioned it.
Now, before that time when you walked into the barbershop and said, "I got to make some extra money," had you done anything along those lines?
No, I stole from this. You know, stole candy.
Candy, yeah, we all did that. Yeah,
yeah,
nothing.
Yeah, no, nothing.
And you weren't doing drugs or anything at the time.
No, I mean I was drinking, but nothing.
Pretty much what teenagers do,
right?
A beer here, a beer there, yeah.
Right, and then, as I grew older, I just kept doing cons and schemes, and I had a legitimate job, and then I had this other life.
What were the cons? What kind of cons would you do?
Oh, we did insurance fraud. I did.
How did that work?
Well, there were different ones. I don't know if I want to.
So in other words, you call me up saying you're selling insurance and you need insurance?
Oh, no. No.
I get you. Like, you know, I busted the windshield. And
right, whatever. Busted the windshield. My car got stolen.
Yeah.
Everything was taken out of it. And I had clothes in the trunk. And I, you know, and you know, so I kept that going for years.
Did you ever get arrested?
Not in Cleveland. But I had, you know, there was a couple of guys that were trying to screw me out of some commissions on another scam. And I beat them, and they got pissed off, and they wanted to have me killed.
You beat them up?
No, I just beat.
Oh.
I got money from them instead of them stealing it from me.
So what was the scam? Tell me one of your more creative scams.
Well,
or this one maybe.
We used to sell Naugahyde table coverings. We'd lease them to
I grew up in the furniture business. That's so funny.
And
Naugahyde table coverings.
Right.
That are tacked down or just
lay over
a tablecloth.
Right. Right.
But Naugahyde.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it was useless.
Yeah.
But we'd go into restaurants and we'd sell them, and we'd sell the franchises. We still sell franchises. I mean, I did Florida Land.
Okay, but back up. So why is that a scam that you're selling them Naugahyde table?
Well, because nobody needed it, and it was a hustle.
Oh,
let's
okay.
put it this way.
All right, gotcha.
Okay, and they were trying to beat me, and instead I got the money that they were trying to beat me out of. They got pissed off.
Were you ever worried about, you know, people with guns and for your life and all that? Now you're starting to dabble in.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what happened, okay? That they went to the local mafia, one of the local mafia people, and he happened to be my adopted godfather. So he just told them, forget it, stop it.
This guy's protected.
He's protected. And he looked at me and he said, you're getting sloppy. It's time for you to leave town. So I left. I left Cleveland. I moved to California.
That's how it works. Like you can't leave for like a month. You're gone.
Yeah, he said, and I couldn't get a legit job anymore.
And the sloppiness was a concern for them or
for me,
for you that
yeah
you're gonna get so basically you're gonna get whacked
right
if
I'm
you
gonna
keep
get,
this up.
I'm gonna get into trouble. Yeah,
serious trouble.
Yep. So I moved out to California. I went to work. My brother lived out. My eldest brother, who passed away 16 years ago, lived out here. He'd just been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. And so I came out to help him in his business. And then I went back into the automobile business, and I was selling cars.
Legit?
And, yeah, legit. Legit. For a while.
When you would do legit things, was it boring? So that's not sort of a made-up a fallacy in the movies or TV. It really is less exciting versus scamming on the insurance or selling Naugahyde
right.
cable. Yeah.
Right.
So you feel yourself emotionally itchy to like, this sucks.
When you're in that place, okay, when you have that mindset, when you're living a split life, when excitement is the only thing that gets you out of anxiety. So I drank and I stole to get out of the inner feelings of anxiety. That was my way out.
Was there a little
my
bit of
escape?
The, was there a little bit of the Goodfellas movie in this? Because it feels a little bit like sort of that. Because I mean, I grew up around these mafia guys, and it was really like,
oh yeah,
just living day to day. You're a rube if you go through the system of, you know, college and get a regular job. Right. We're going to make $1 million the easy way, standing in front of the social club. I know all these guys.
Right. It was, you know, you were a jamoke, I used to call
people. That's the term. That's the term we would use.
Right.
Yeah. You
that
were a jamoke. Yeah.
That was the term.
And my cousin would stand in front of the social club, handsome guy, like could have been a male model. And he's a really sweet guy now, and he's fine now. He's not doing much, anything bad. And it wasn't like, he wasn't killing anybody. It was just, you know, nickel and dime stuff. But
right.
like. But you go, like, he's a bright guy. Just, I think he couldn't do what you said you experienced, which is that the boredom of sitting in that job, and there's this and there's that, and the excitement, and then he stands in front of the social club, and he's got his tight, well, and he's, you know, smoking cigarettes.
Right,
and
well, plus, I didn't want to take orders from some dumb boss.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So part of it was a puffed-up idea of myself, and...
And it's burying the anxiety.
Right.
Right.
And so what happened out here was I started to get arrested.
Doing what? Same stuff?
Yeah, check kiting. You know, I was kiting checks. I was.
Explain to people what check kiting means in case.
Well, I would write checks on accounts that were closed. Or I would.
So you'd have an actual, you'd get an account, you'd get put a couple bucks in it.
Yeah, or I would steal somebody else's account.
But you have the actual physical check
oh, yeah.
with the name on it. How
yeah.
do you steal somebody's checks and account?
Because people would, back in the day, people would throw out, you know, checks if they changed their bank account. They
never, so you'd just find them in the garbage.
Right.
So by the time you write 5, 6, 7, 8 checks, but then they catch up with you and then.
Right. Oh, yeah. So I used to do this thing. We used to do this thing where we would write a check from a company and put it into a new, you know, into an account. And we would split it up between a savings account and a checking account. Well, in those days, in order for the bank to do it, they had to actually cash the check. So I'd walk in 2 days later. Usually there was a 5 to 7 day hold on it. I'd walk in 2 days later and take out all the money.
Mm.
And then it wouldn't be my fault. The bank gave me the money.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, so I started to get... in trouble. I was
drinking and doing
drinking. I had been selling cars, and then I started wholesaling cars, and I would spin back the odometers, you know, and I mean, just it was a terrible life.
You're a smart Jew, but you used it for evil.
Right. That's it. That's it. And then in 86, I got arrested again, the end of 86, and I knew I was going to the joint.
For what? What was that for?
For bad checks.
So it just kept building up, on your record.
Yeah.
When you first got arrested, was it just sort of the time served or they?
Yeah, they gave me probation. And
now, where do the drugs and the real issues with drugs kick in?
I didn't have issues with drugs. I mean, I'm a drunk.
Oh, okay.
But when they arrested me, I was drinking a gallon of whiskey a day.
Oh. I had a buddy that killed himself, alcoholic. He was drinking just vodka. Got divorced, couldn't deal with it, wasn't seeing his kids, felt guilty, couldn't fall asleep, and need something to fall asleep.
Right.
And then they found him dead in his apartment.
Yeah, how I never got alcohol poisoning is miraculous.
It's brutal. This guy was a Harvard undergrad, Columbia Law School grad. It can happen to anybody.
Yeah. That's the thing. See, everybody, what happened was, Paul, was I was asking myself the wrong questions. I was saying, how do I get out of this feeling rather than how do I go through it?
Deal with it, own it, and then move on.
Right.
Equip yourself with something to deal with it.
Exactly. I was asking, how do I get out? How do I escape?
Yeah, but that's a normal thing. I would ask the same thing. Like, I got to get away from it. No one
right,
does.
Because we don't teach our children and we don't teach people to ask the right questions. Most of us have the right answers to the wrong questions.
So what should people be teaching their children? Because I'm sure they're...
That life... is life's in session, and that there's going to be things in life that we're going to have to go through, we're going to have to figure out, and if we live in truth, if we live transparent, there's always a way to figure something out.
So when you have anxiety, what does living in truth mean?
It means I talk about it.
With
I don't know
with a
somebody,
therapist or a wife or whoever.
A wife, a friend, a rabbi.
I'm feeling anxious today. I don't know why. I'm just stressing out. I can't. Just getting it out helps.
Right. As soon as I talk about it, all of a sudden it's not so big.
And why, when you were 16, 17, 20, I don't know, this goes into your 20s and 30s, why weren't you able to talk about it?
I was too embarrassed.
Yeah. I can understand that.
Too embarrassed.
Well, that was that culture back then. It's very different now.
Well, it is and it isn't.
So that was society then. We're talking 60s, 70s, 80s, right?
Right. But it is and it isn't, you see, because kids today and even adults today, nobody talks about what's real. Everybody's still trying to look good.
Yeah. So, especially with social media.
Right. Alcoholics Anonymous says you can't save your face and your ass at the same time.
That's hilarious.
So what you see is what you get. I am just me. I had this spiritual awakening when I was arrested that God was trying to tell me something, and I had to sit in prison until I could figure it out.
Now, when people say that, because I've never met anybody that has had it, physically, like what happened? In other words, you were sort of just lying in bed, and then you woke up one morning?
No, I was on the phone to my first wife and telling her to come pick up money because I had a couple grand. I was on my way to Las Vegas to bet a 10-team football parlay. That was going to pay $350 to $1.
Uh-huh.
And I said, come pick up this money. She said, what bondsman do you want me to call? I said, don't call anybody. The man upstairs is trying to tell me something, and I have to sit here till I can figure it out. Paul, this is 30 years later. I don't know where those words came from because they were not part of my consciousness.
I was going to say, what was different about that arrest?
I have no idea.
You were still drinking at the time.
Yeah.
Hey, by the way, when you're locked up and you're an alcoholic, you can't get booze. You go into detox. What happens?
Yeah,
the shakes and all that shit?
Yeah, that time I had the shakes.
Oh.
I had the shakes.
Do they give you anything to deal with?
Nah. Nah. But what happened was that I called my brother after that, who's a rabbi, and I said, you got to send me a Bible and a
prayer. So through all this, you had a brother who's a rabbi?
Oh, yeah.
Jesus.
Right.
This is great.
Well, he became a rabbi. What else could I do but be a criminal? It was the only right. thing that made sense.
Would he pull you aside and try to say, what are you doing?
All the time.
What would you do? Yes him to death?
I would yes him, and then I'd tell him, go fuck yourself.
Older or younger brother?
Older.
Yeah.
So what happened was I started to study, and I started to read the Bible, and I really immersed myself in it. And I saw that every hero in the Hebrew Bible has clay feet. Every one of them is imperfect.
Clay feet, meaning they
make mistakes.
Yeah. Right.
Okay, nobody's perfect.
So that made you feel better about your imperfections.
Right.
That alleviated some of the anxiety.
Yeah, and I read the story of Jacob, and Jacob wrestled with, he had screwed his brother. He was a liar, a cheat, a con, and a thief.
Mm-hmm.
Screwed his brother, lied to his father, conned his father, and then he had this wrestling match with himself. And he had to have this dark night of the soul. What am I going to do? I'm going to meet my brother.
Hmm.
And I understood at that point that I had to wrestle with my demons. I couldn't just try and wall them off.
How old are you at that point?
At that point, I'm 35 years old.
Hmm. You're still a young guy, yeah.
Yeah, and so that started me on this road to recovery. And then when I got out, I went to work at Beit Tshuva. There wasn't a lot of people hiring a salesman who had a 5-page rap sheet for theft.
Wow.
And
what was your first job there?
I ran the thrift shop.
Okay.
A little hole in the wall down near downtown L.A.
Now, were you having the temptations to get back to the sexy life of crime?
Nope.
Boy, something really happened. How long were you in jail?
I was in the joint 2.5 years that time.
And that was a consistent...
2.5 years.
During that 2.5 years, it was a consistent effort to understand yourself and kind of use religion and the Bible to get yourself right?
Right, yeah.
You didn't go, this is bullshit.
No.
Isn't there a temptation there because you got criminals who are just committing or planning crimes
in
the
joint? Listen, I was still hustling in the joint. I mean, I wasn't perfect.
Well, now, wait a minute. So, wait. Now, are you a minimum?
Minimum.
But aren't you worried you're going to hustle the wrong guy and get whacked around?
Oh, no. I mean, I would...
Outside the joint.
No, what happened was we would have... things from the kitchen used to find their way.
fall off the truck, as it's a...
Right.
Yeah.
And I would then go sell them for cigarettes.
And the things would be like what?
Food, you know, briskets, eggs.
Would you have like a
institutional
you have a trench
cancer.
Coat with like hooks with brisket hanging on it?
No, I was the rabbi's clerk, so I kept it in the chapel.
Oh, you're hilarious. But how are you squaring that? You're doing the same thing you did outside. You go, wait, hang on. You're at the youth center right. at the thing. And,
but, each so, day I got less. Each day I got less.
But and, you wouldn't, okay, you wouldn't and, go grab some stuff from the kitchen, and then that night you open the Bible and go, man, this is fucked up. I'm leading a double life here.
Right.
Just like you did outside, inside.
Right. And the difference was that I actually was becoming more and more aware of it.
Mm. And why were you still hustling in the joint? Just the excitement of it?
Well, no, I needed cigarettes. You know, my first wife sort of stopped. She didn't really want a lot to do with me after the second trip to the joint. You know,
I
my kid didn't want much to do with me. And, you know,
how many kids you have?
One. Okay. I have a daughter.
You get along with her well now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're out. You're at the thrift shop. And, how does moving to...
Well, because I was...
Being a rabbi playing
to this. What happened was, then I went to work... the secretary left, and I went to work as the secretary, as the person there. And I started doing classes. I started studying with people, leading services. And I just kept growing both in my job and in my own spiritual journey.
Mm.
Since 1987, I've had a rabbi. I've had a spiritual guide. And that person just knows me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm unafraid to be who I am.
But you're a rabbi, yeah?
Now I'm a rabbi, yeah. However, I kept going. I still have a rabbi.
So for people who aren't Jewish, what does the term mean, I have a rabbi? Is it sort of, I was raised Catholic. You have a priest, you go to your church, you see your priest, you say hello, maybe you go talk to him if you have a problem. But there's not a, at least for me and most people that I know, there's not that sort of day-to-day or weekly sort of guidance, mentorship.
No, that's what a spiritual guide is.
That's what a rabbi is.
That's what a rabbi should be. Not all rabbis are like
okay.
that.
So it's like the church.
And I chose to find people who would be that.
And you had a particular rabbi that took you under his wing, so to speak?
Yeah, I've had three. Huh. My rabbi now is Rabbi Ed Feinstein from Valley Beth Shalom.
No, that guy? Yeah. He's an asshole. No, I'm just kidding.
And he's the best. And we've been studying together since 1993.
And when you say studying, what are you're always learning. What are you studying?
Always learning.
What are you learning?
We learn text. We learn different texts, and we talk about how it's relevant to life.
The meaning of the text.
But only in how it helps me live better.
Hmm. How do you feel you can, you know, nothing's perfect.
That's a big thing. Nothing's perfect is a big thing, because when you think about it,
that was your albatross, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's for everybody. I mean, you're cool just hanging out. How many people think that they have to be perfect on their podcast, perfect as the announcer, perfect, perfect, perfect? They have this measurement that's bullshit.
It is, but I feel it in other aspects of my life, especially when it comes to my job.
Right.
And I expect it of others.
Right, but there is no perfection.
Right. But I feel like if I know it's done 100%, 100% right, I can sleep well at night. And then the outcome is the outcome.
It's never 100% right. All you can do is the best you can do in this moment. 10 minutes from now, your best changes.
Yeah.
The next interview you have, your best changes.
Right.
So in Judaism, there's this concept called teshuvah, which translates as repentance, return, and response.
Mm-hmm.
It actually means repair, change, and hope. And so every day I do a tshuva, I do an inventory of myself. Where did I miss the mark? Where did I hit the bullseye?
Oh, I was going to ask, it's not a point you reach in your life where you're like, okay, I've gone through repair. Was it repair?
Repair, change, and hope. No, it's daily.
What is the hope? What are you hoping for?
Well, every time I repair something and I change myself, I have hope that I can continue to grow.
Do you lie?
No.
Like even little lies, like, oh, I missed your call and you just didn't want to, like, do you?
Yeah, I'm sure I do
bit.
That. Yeah.
So what is the repair you have to do? Because you sound like, look, well, you're a spiritual leader yourself now. You sound like you
have
your
repair. I always have to repair because I'm not going to be perfect. I may, So I'm walking by or I'm doing something and somebody says hello or somebody says, listen, I need a minute. And I'm in my own world because I'm concentrating on something and I'm oblivious to them. Okay.
So then how do you repair that in your mind the next day or that night where you go, boy, that guy, I should have given him a minute.
I go to the person and I say, listen, you said hello to me or you called me, you wanted something, and I just blew you off. I'm really sorry. Let's sit down and talk.
Oh, so you literally go out and repair it. It's not a mental exercise.
It's got to be a physical thing because you're the person I harmed.
And then what's the change in that?
The change in it is that I become more aware.
And the hope is what?
The hope is I'm going to be less oblivious.
So you won't repeat that.
Right.
This sounds exhausting to live like this. I mean, it has merit and I commend you for it, but it sounds like you have to be very on top of your own feelings, and that can be exhausting, no?
I find it exhilarating.
There you go.
Because if I don't, then I'm not being human.
You're not living. You're not present. You're not. Yeah.
Right. I'm not being human. So one of the people that I love to study is Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. He's got this great line: indifference to the sublime wonder of living is the root of all sin.
Indifference to the sublime
wonder of living.
Yeah. Listen, I've seen talk to people to get guys, even talk to a life coach, and there's a lot of the messages that come through in conversations like this is sort of appreciate what you have, appreciate life, appreciate in the moment. It's very hard to do, especially in a very competitive society that we live in and your goal-oriented society. It's very hard to just say, I just appreciate that I have a life and I've got a wife and a kid and blah, blah, blah. I understand it on a theoretical level, but I think it's hard, at least for somebody like myself, to just be at peace with that and just that.
Okay, so here's the thing. I don't know about peace.
Unless I'm missing your point.
A little bit, I think. Maybe not. We'll find out. I'm in gratitude for what I have all the time. That doesn't mean I don't push the envelope.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
So I don't settle.
But before you were on the other end of the spectrum in that part of your life where you were just sort of wasting away.
Right. I was trying to grab. So now I appreciate, there's a saying in Judaism, who is rich? One who is happy with what he has.
Well, that's hard.
But if you're not happy, see, here's the deal. If you're not happy with what you have, no matter how much more you get, you're not going to be happy.
Right. Well, I don't know. I could hit a number and I'd be happy. I tell you.
You know something? I know guys.
I could hit a number and I'd be happy.
I know guys who've hit the number.
Yeah.
And when you say, well, you're happy? They say, well, you know, just a little bit
more. I
got
a 40-foot boat, but the 48 looks nice.
That's right.
It's got a second bathroom.
So, you know, John D. Rockefeller.
Yeah.
When asked, how much is enough money? You said a little bit more than what I have.
That's awesome. So what you're saying is, okay, be happy with what you have, but at the same time, it's okay to strive for more.
You have to.
But don't be striving for more and be unhappy with what you have.
Exactly.
Then there's a huge hole.
Right.
And that's what's
so are you married?
I'm married. I have a kid.
Okay. So do you want your life?
Do I want my life?
Yeah.
The way I have it now?
Yeah.
For the most part. I'd like it to be more comfortable financially.
All right.
Now, I walked away from a very comfortable
exactly.
Wall Street
life. That's where you're full of shit.
What do you mean?
If comfortable financially
you
was really
left.
The thing, you wouldn't have left.
Well, you know, I didn't want to look back and say I should have, and I had a creative thing I wanted to fulfill.
Okay.
But
so you want the life that you have.
With a little bit more money. Yeah. Got a kid's got to go to school, blah, blah, blah.
But
you know what I mean?
You hear what I'm saying.
Yeah, I know.
So think of all the guys that don't want the life that they have.
Do me a favor.
They don't even appreciate it.
Listen, why don't you just, for me, come up with a scam, get me some money. Just this one time, break out of your life. Just for me. Get me
here's a
million and a half.
Here's
I'll split it with
thing.
You. And then nobody will know.
Years ago, years ago, there was this Medicare scam where they were doing guys I knew were in the medical supply,
mm-hmm.
and they were picking up bums and doing this, you know. And I thought to myself, wow, I'm making 20 grand a year at that time going to rabbinical school. So, you know, wow, I could do this for about 4 or 5 months. Because guys are making 20, 40 grand a month. Mm. I said, do this. My school's paid for. Everything's great. That's the first thought that goes through my head.
Yeah.
Then I start laughing. I'm sitting with a guy, and he's telling me the story. And I all of a sudden break out laughing. He said, what are you laughing about? I said, well, I'm thinking to myself, I could do it for 4 or 5 months. And I know I'd never last 4 or 5 months because I keep going. And, yeah. and you know, I mean, that's addictive too.
It's like alcohol. Once you say, oh, just one drink, and right. then I'll stop.
Right. AA says it so well. One is too many and 1,000's not enough.
You have this theory of addiction. You say addiction is a hole in the soul. It is a spiritual malady that says there is something wrong. Recovery is about I matter and I'm a holy soul. And when I started the interview, I said I wanted to get to this. I've not seen the a theory of addiction quite put that way. I know there's always tends to be spiritual aspects of addiction, but explain your theory and how you work with people in recovery.
So most people have no idea of how much they matter.
How much they what?
They matter.
Yeah.
So, like, you have a sense because you have a podcast and you're in entertainment and this and that. And I've done this so many times. I've talked to kids with their parents, and I ask them, how much do you matter to your parents? I don't know. And the parents are aghast. They say, what do you mean you're the most important thing? And the kids say, well, you're always on me for this, or you're asking me that. How do I know that just I matter without me doing something?
Mm.
So what happens is we grow up spiritually bankrupt because we don't realize that we have intrinsic value.
Mm-hmm.
Judaism says that you have infinite worth and dignity.
Mm-hmm.
There's nobody, okay, there's no soul that's worth more or has more dignity than you. You're the most important person in the world. So is your wife. So is your kid.
I understand that.
Okay.
But here's where it's David versus Goliath. And religion, you pick it. Judaism, Catholicism is the David. And the Goliath is America, society, capitalism, the way people are treated. I will tell you, if you and I walked into a room, hang on, you and I is me, okay? And then you turn around and you walk into that same room with Tom Hanks, pick a star, or a billionaire, pick one.
Right.
Bloomberg. You will be treated differently by everybody in that room than you were when you were with me, and so will that person. So what every single human being is up against is your theory is right spot on. You matter for you. But we live in a world where people are treated based on the size of their car, the size of their dick, how hot the woman is that they're with, and all of that. So how are people supposed to combat that?
Okay. I think it's a personal thing. You're on the road.
Mm-hmm.
You don't put your kid to sleep. Now, you have to be on the road.
Hmm.
Okay, this isn't a put down.
Right.
Do you know how much that matters to your kid?
Oh, yeah.
You miss the game, you miss the recital, the play, whatever.
Yeah.
But most parents...
And he knows. He knows how important he is to me. He knows.
Right.
Because I did not get told that a lot.
Exactly.
So I'm cutting that bad cycle with him.
Right. So you see, but most people, all right, if you blow by somebody,
yeah,
right, and especially you probably get a million calls,
mm-hmm,
to interview people, all this kind of stuff, and you make a choice.
Right.
When you say no to somebody, that impacts them.
Oh, sure.
But most people don't even take responsibility for that impact.
But you have to say no. You can't say yes to everybody.
Of course.
Right.
You just have to know that it impacts.
Mm-hmm.
So the way you say no then changes.
Right. How do you say no that it, in a way that it doesn't feel like a no?
No, it feels like a no, yet you still recognize their dignity and their worth.
Yeah.
Rather than just blowing it off.
Yeah. My mother always used to say, if you really want to hurt somebody, ignore them.
Right.
I was getting in a hassle with some kids and getting in fist fights. And she said, you know what the best? Just ignore them. Walk by them. People can't stand being ignored.
Right. So everything I do matters. What I was talking about before, okay? When I don't say hello to somebody, it matters.
Yeah.
And I have to be responsible for that.
Yeah.
So it's not self-aggrandizement. It's that I'm important. And on a religious or spiritual basis, I'm here as a divine reminder. God needs me to do things.
And you think it's to work with people with addiction?
Absolutely. People who have, see, I don't even limit myself to addiction problems anymore as far as what people think of as addiction. Anybody who's not living life well, who's not happy, joyous, and free.
So you're like a rabbi, a therapist, and a life coach all wrapped into one. And
rabbi,
an addiction counselor.
Right.
And what is the biggest challenge for you in your work? What is there a consistent challenge, the biggest hurdle working with people who are drunks or drug addicts? What is the one that's really difficult for you to
get for them to see their worth?
And how do you eventually get someone to see their worth?
Because I switch it. I help them go from being in shame to being guilty.
Guilty of
whatever they've done wrong. See, most people won't admit guilt because they're too ashamed. They'll deny, deny, deny. You know, I don't know.
So ashamed equals
I don't know
deny.
If you've ever heard this term, but a lot of people for many years have been giving alternative facts to situations.
Yeah. Well, Kellyanne Conway just used that one. Yeah. Oh, fantastic.
I tweeted, when I did it, the judge called me a liar and put me in the joint.
That's hilarious. So true.
But really, you think about, no, I didn't hurt your feelings.
Mm.
Of course you did.
Mm.
So the deal is that I'm responsible for it and I acknowledge it.
So then it becomes guilt. And from the guilt,
I can repair it.
How do you stop?
John Bradshaw said, shame is for who I am. Guilt is for what I've done.
And they're drinking and doing drugs mainly because they're burying something. They're ashamed of their behavior.
They live in shame. They do not feel that they're worth being alive.
And then once you get them, but what can you say to me? Okay, so you get me to admit that I did some bad things. I have guilt.
No, first I get you to see how important you are.
But how do you, how do you, like, let's say I
could. It depends. I can't do a therapy.
But no. But an abandoned person by their parents, by all rights, they should feel like they're not worth anything. They've been treated poorly in their life. You give them something to grab onto.
Right. That's their soul.
Yeah.
That's why everybody's.
And that's just through the conversation.
Everybody's a holy soul.
And so you're getting to the root of that problem. Then all the alcohol and the other shit goes away because you don't need it.
Right. You don't need to hide anymore.
Wow. Interesting.
I mean, this is all addiction, money, power, prestige, all these things, okay? Not enough money, not having enough, et cetera, all comes from this feeling of not being worth it.
But again, it goes back to self-imposed, but it's also society puts that on
us. I understand. So fuck society. Okay, because here's the deal. You're a holy soul. You matter.
Mm.
The world is less without you in your proper place.
It's a wonderful life, right? That idea.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
All of Judaism points to that. And there's no perfection. None. Mm. There's a Hasidic tradition that you should carry two pieces of paper in your pocket. One that says the world was created for my sake, and the other one that says I'm but dust and ashes.
Hmm.
So I used to keep, I wrote it on two pieces of paper, and I kept it in my pockets for 10, 15
it's
years.
It's On for Dust and Ashes, and what's
that? I am but dust and ashes. And the other one says, the world was created for my sake.
So that one, the first, the less, the one you just said about created for my sake sounds a little grand.
Yeah. But Judaism believes that the world was created for
but
the
I
sake.
Thought you I thought it was a more humble approach that you take to life, no?
Well, what's humble?
To say that the world was created for my sake, I thought it would be more like I'm here to serve the world and make it a better place.
It means that. It means that.
Oh, it sounds like it's my world and you all just live in it, but no.
It's really the other way. But the thing is that so when I first learned that, I put I'm but dust and ashes in my pocket with money. And the world was created for my sake in my other pocket that had nothing in it.
What is the significance of doing the money in one and
so not? every time I took out the money, I had that piece of paper and I remembered how much money I have doesn't mean shit.
So what does I'm but dust and ashes mean?
It means I'm not that great. I'm not the end all be all.
Oh, and the other one balances it the other way.
Exactly. But you see, when you're talking about humble, humility is knowing your place in the world and living it. So knowing you're a father and really living as a father, knowing you're a husband and living as a husband, knowing that you're a comedian and living that, and knowing you're you do podcasts and interviews and really living it and being immersed in it.
But it's okay to strive.
That's humble.
But it's okay to, while I'm that comedian, strive to be a bigger comedian or more successful.
Because you have to keep growing, otherwise you're dying.
So you're not saying don't have ambition and drive, just appreciate where you are when you're there.
Right.
Okay.
Think of how many things you've missed because you want to be someplace else.
Hmm. Yeah. My wife says this to me all the time. She's very good at just, she said, sometimes you just need to be.
All of us need to be.
Yeah. No, I know, it's a lot.
So I'm totally immersed right now, no matter what else is going on, what I have to go back to, what right. I came from. I'm right here, right this minute. This right. is the most important thing I can be doing right now. You're the most important person in front of me right this minute. And if I don't appreciate it, enjoy it.
You're missing something.
Right.
You miss out. Yeah. Well, I could talk to you forever. When I come back to L.A., I want to have you on again.
I'd love
just
it.
Talk, you know, kind of we got your background out, but. These are things that I personally struggle with. Other people do, I'm sure. And you're just a really great guy. And
Thank you.
Remind me
you're
of my
great.
Italian family, Jewish version. Jews and Italians are exactly alike.
Right.
Big family, loud.
Well, that's what.
Well, you sons of bitches have all the money. The Italians, we don't.
Yeah, right. So here was the deal. When I grew up, okay, yeah. There were Jews, Italians, and everybody else.
Yeah. Yeah. My wife is a WASP. I didn't know what a WASP was. White Anglo-Saxon Protestant Mayflower people. Right? Right. I didn't know what that was.
Who ever heard of them?
It's Italian. All the Italians lived in that neighborhood. There were a couple of Jews, and
right.
It's the same.
Right.
Very, very, very emotional.
Right. In Cleveland, they were always together.
Yeah. So funny. Same thing in Rhode Island.
Right.
The book is Finding Recovery and Yourself in Torah, A Daily Spiritual Path to Wholeness. Where can they get the book?
They can get it on Amazon.com.
Okay, please go. This is a lovely man, Rabbi Mark Borovitz, and turned his life around. If you're thinking of doing an insurance scam, I would suggest you call him. He probably can help you with that as well. He can do everything. He's like a one-stop shop. He'll fix your head. He'll get some extra money. You'll kite some checks. It'll be good. Thank you so much for listening.
Thanks.
Please remember to go and review the podcast on iTunes. It's always good for people to hear nice things about this. I hope you've enjoyed this interview as much as I have. I'm on the road March and April all over the country. Come check me out. Go to paulmercurio.com. Rabbi, thank you so much.
Thank you, Paul. This has been my honor.
I hope you... Oh, thank you.
I
wish everybody said that to me.
It's just been great. No. You're fantastic.
Oh, well, I don't know about that, but thank you. But this was fascinating, and we got to do more of this. I want to have you on again. And good luck, and I think it's great that you're helping other people with what you came out of. That's
thank
the right
you.
Thing to do.
Thank
All right,
you.
Folks.
God bless.
Yep. See you next week.
Bye now.
A Westwood One podcast production.